Hi there, this is Kendra Adachi, and I host the Lazy Genius Podcast. And I need to make sure that you have heard about the new KFC chicken nuggets. You have never had nuggets like these before, 100% white meat and hand-breaded in KFC's original recipe. KFC has been a family favorite for years, and now we can get all of the delicious KFC flavor we love in one amazing chicken nugget. Order new Kentucky Fried Chicken Nuggets, now available at participating KFCs near you.
Well, you know, the problem is you don't have fathers. They're in fucking jail. Like, you can't have it both ways.
Welcome to Manic Rambling Spiral. I am Heather B. Armstrong.
And I am John R. Bray.
This week, we are joined by a policy wonk.
We love policy wonks on Manic Ramblings.
Somebody complained that we were featuring too many policy wonks.
Because we had the audacity to talk about parental leave.
So our guest this week is Kelly Wickham Hurst, a very good friend of mine. Kelly has worked in education and is currently running a nonprofit called Being Black at School. And I wanted to bring her on, especially this week, considering everything that is going on, especially with school shootings, with what's happening in Louisiana. There's a huge list of issues that Kelly has a lot of insight and expertise into. Kelly, do you want to talk a little bit about what you bring to the table?
I'm a troublemaker. I like to start with that. Which really means that any industry in which I've worked, I've been a troublemaker. Mm-hmm. And it's because I think I like that you even called me a policy wonk. I'm like, do I know policy? I know some policy, right? I get policy. Or I think I know politics, because to be a person in this country and to live in the margins, you have to understand politics. Politics matters in your life very much. So when people tell me that they don't get into politics, I just think that must be really nice for you, that nothing about policy has affected you in such a way that you think it's important to be involved. How right. lucky, how privileged of you. So I was a troublemaker in the classroom when I was a teacher. I taught 6th through 12th grade at various schools. And I kept seeing really terrible instances of institutional racism, but I did not have that language for it at the time. And then I thought, I know, I will fix this by becoming an administrator. And that was the dumbest thing I could have done. Because you don't fix it as an administrator. You just are now in charge of meting out the discipline and the consequences for the things that you had already seen in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I found myself in this position where I was like, oh man, it's the whole system. The whole damn system is rigged. And it's not, if you are a white middle class child in this country, you can navigate the system really well. And no one else has it that easy. So as an administrator, I kept seeing instances of really blatant racism coming from other educators, coming from my colleagues at the administrative level. And I kept trying to point it out. And then everybody kept calling me a troublemaker. So I was like, fine, fuck it. Then I'm going to be a big old troublemaker. That doesn't turn out well for me, by the way. The end of this story is that I just kept getting moved from school to school. And I was not going along with status quo and whatever policies we kept putting in place. The devil is in the details when it comes to institutional racism, and the details are policy. So in that instance, Heather, yeah, I'm a policy wonk.
You're still blogging, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. And when did you start your website?
I started about 12 years ago, right when we met. I was just thinking our relationship is almost a teenager, Heather.
Did you start as a mommy blogger?
I did, but I didn't think of it that way, because my children were older than most of the other mommy bloggers. So
yeah,
like I'm a grandmother now, and so I was talking about my teenagers at the time and what was going on, and the mommy blogging set was still talking about what diapers to choose and what is co-sleeping, and I'm like, that is not my issue. I'm not talking about that. Which, of course, you know, as Heather knows, that spiraled really into me talking about why I was the age I was talking about teenagers, because I was a teen mom. Mm-hmm. And so then I started talking about what shaped me and formed me as a teen parent, and what policies and what things in my life had been difficult from that. And then that kind of naturally followed into, let's also talk about other things, like why it's also hard to be me, because I'm a Black woman in a society that doesn't really want to hear my voice. So I never really identified with it because of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never considered you like a mommy blogger. This says a lot about me. I considered you a writer. I considered you a very intellectual writer is what I have always considered you that.
Okay, that's the nicest thing ever. It's going to go on my business card.
Well, I mean, so...
Deuce thinks I'm a writer.
So I would watch... So last year, we went on a road trip, you and I, to Dad 2.0. We drove from Salt Lake City to San Diego. And you were one of the only people who knew that I was about to go into treatment, by the way.
Right.
Yeah. I shared with Kelly that what I was about to go through. And I remember, like, we stopped in Vegas on the way down, and you would compose Facebook posts in like 10 minutes that would have taken me like 4 days to write. And I was like, you just fucking wrote that? Holy shit. And I need to explain the significance of like your, of our bond here, because back in 2014, I was speaking on a keynote panel at Mom 2.0 with five different other people about using our voices for the greater good. And Laura Mays, before the panel, stood up and said, I'm going to have invite someone on stage to read what I think is the most important component to this discussion. And Kelly got up on stage and read a blog post she had written calling out everybody in the room for not blogging about racism. And she's like, I see you hashtagging LGBTQ. I see you hashtagging breastfeeding. I see you hashtagging feminism. Why are you not talking about race? And It was almost like she was saying, Heather Armstrong, Heather Armstrong, Heather Armstrong. And I got so red in the face. And like, I kept sinking lower and lower and lower in my seat. And afterwards, I approached you and I said, I feel like you were talking directly at me because I have not broached that subject once on my website. I was scared to. And I remember the words. I was like, people are going to come at me and saying, what the fuck do you have to say about this? And you looked at me and you said, when have you ever done anything right, Heather?
Stay in some shit, girl.
And I was like, you're right. I mean, people are going to call me out on anything that I do anyway. And she's like, you were like, your voice is really important about this. And it was your encouragement that made me. And then you were the one who recommended now my favorite book, The Warmth of Other Suns, that having in my parents, having grown up in Jim Crow South, like it was, you transformed my life. I mean, there's no getting around that.
I can recall that moment with some pinpoint clarity, Heather. Mm-hmm. Mostly because, number one, it was a moment when, God bless Laura Mays, who was like, you can read anything you want. And I was like, oh, I'm about to hurt your feelings then. I'm not going to be nice. And I showed it to her and she just went, ooh, okay, go for it. And it was really around, we were having this sort of national conversation about race without really having a national conversation about race, which is, technically what we do in this country is we're always trying to identify the problem without ever going, and I think it might be racism. And I could have heard a pin drop in that room and I knew I was stepping on toes, and it was really around Trayvon Martin. Like, and I kept thinking of his mother, Sabrina Fulton, and how so many blog posts always talked about this camaraderie and this community of moms who found this wonderful place where they could share themselves, their full selves, all of the complications about being a mother. And I thought, here's a mother whose child was shot and killed in the most horrific manner. It's on tape. It's become a national issue. And not one of these moms is saying, oh my God, her child is dead. And that is horrible. And so I remember getting off that stage thinking, well, I remember reading it and thinking, oh, damn it, I can't hear anything out there in the crowd. Like, I can't read this at all. Shit. You know, when and you go, oh God, what's happening out there? What was happening out there, Heather? I don't know.
Oh, all of us were called out. And all of us realized that we had been called out and that we were properly called out. Like, we were guilty of this. We knew it. And, like, you rocked the room. Like, the whole room was shook. Like, you could feel the walls vibrating with everybody in the room going, she's talking to me. She's talking to me.
Yeah, well, when you can't read your audience, you just get more and more, oh, fuck. They are either going to boo me off this stage or I don't, like, that was really the only option that I was considering at the time. I'm like, they're going to be really mad about this. And and I finished and it was a standing ovation. And I was just like, oh, wait, I think I just picked a scab.
Yeah, it was like a transforming moment, I think, for the whole mommy blogging landscape.
You know, Karen Walrond, who we just love, said to me when I was coming off the stage, she was actually standing up. I remember she was standing, but she was also walking towards me, which is great because I kept thinking, now I'm going to fall down because, like, I can't believe what is transpiring in this room. And she hugged me immediately and said, I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of you. This was what needed to be said, and you said it. And that's when I was, it's funny because then I went to sit at the table that you were sitting at because you had just gotten done speaking and your jaw was just like, your mouth was open. I remember at the time. And I remember somebody else sitting at the table, Meredith, who turned around and she said to me, who are you? Which felt a little bit like, oh, I don't know what to say now. And I think that's when I started saying, I'm a troublemaker. That's what I do. I'm a troublemaker. But, you know, Karen has also said in many ways, and John, I don't know if you've seen a picture of me, but I'm a very light-skinned Black woman. And so Karen always says that I'm everyone's safe Black person because they feel like they can ask me questions and talk to me. And I think that a lot of that comes out from, my experiences. My mom is white. My dad is Black. I got to watch this world. But my mother very clearly said to me and my sisters when we were very young, I need to raise you like Black girls because the world's going to see you as Black women. Like, you're not going to be able to hide. You are not going to be able to infiltrate and belong to a society that they will not accept you. So I need to treat you like Black girls. And then the other part was just being in education and then being able to watch it. But there are so many people who miss it about me. They think that I'm something. They think that I'm ethnic. They think that I'm exotic looking. And you can't see me, but I'm putting quotation marks around that because it makes me sick to hear that. But I've met a lot of people in my educational career who have just revealed their racism to me because they don't know what I am.
Mm-hmm. And how many years did you spend as an administrator?
10 years as an administrator. Years.
Wow.
Yeah. My first year as an administrator is when I was thinking, oh my God, this is so stupid of me. I can't believe I decided to do this. I had a teacher bring a student over to my office and she was so mad already. She was just on 10, which, by the way, don't do that, teachers. Do not let them see you get that pissed. Like, keep it together. And as she's yelling at this kid and she's telling me all the things he's doing in the classroom, he happens to be a Black boy. And I'm looking at him and I'm thinking to myself, how do I navigate this? Like, she's having a meltdown and he's kind of smirking because he's like, ha ha, I got you. And I learned, obviously, I should have asked him to leave. I should have said, just step out of my office for a minute. And I should have taken all her anger on, but it happened the way it happened. And so I looked at him and said, hey, is this accurate, what she's telling me? He's like, yeah, that's accurate. That's not the problem. I'm like, oh, What's the problem? He goes, we're in here because every time I get in trouble in her class, she's always spreading my business to the streets. And she did not know what he meant by that. So I translated, because that's also what you do as a person of color, as a black person. I said, he's upset because you're obviously telling the whole class why he's in trouble. And I said to him, you know, what's the difference between what that looks like and what other students? He said, well, when a white kid gets in trouble, she goes over and kneels down next to them and she whispers and touches them on their arm and says, can I get you some help? Is there something you don't understand? Or what's going on with you today? That was a profound moment for me to hear a 14-year-old black boy articulate systemic racism in one instance. That's exactly how the system works. So this would have been in 2005, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
You have so many similar stories like that you've told me over the years.
Yes. Too many. A lot.
In a situation like that, though, what happens a month or 2 months or 3 months down the road? I mean, do you see things change or does it just stay exactly the same?
It stays exactly the same. Yeah, they don't, there's no change. The teachers, what I found is that they didn't like it. They thought that I was siding with the kids, which, you know, is like part of my fucking job, right? Like, I'm here to advocate for education that includes teachers and students, and then also parents and support staff and community people. And in trying to say, hey, you know, this is a bias situation we need to talk about, they didn't want to talk about that. Then I just became the bad guy at all times. Mm-hmm.
And they would transfer you to another school and then to another school?
Yes. Yes. Just keep on moving me. And by the last one, that's when I said, and in 2015, I went, I'm done. You don't want to have these conversations and I can't do this work alone. And I think that it was incredibly damaging to my own emotional and mental state. And I got out to save my life, to be honest. Mm-hmm.
And that's when you started being black at school?
Yes. Yes. And I know that's a provocative name and I did that shit on purpose. I will not lie about that. I know that people hear it and go, oh, what? But here's the deal. It says everything you need to say. I'm advocating for black students in school systems. And there's a plethora of research and data out there that tells you exactly why this is necessary.
Yes. And I remember I said something really, really, really stupid to you that I'm really ashamed of in that conversation after you read your piece. We live in a predominantly like 99.9% white state. And there was a black kid in Lita's second grade class. And she was trying to, she's like, she couldn't remember his name. And she was trying to like describe him to me. And she didn't describe his skin color. And I told you this. And I was like, she doesn't see, she didn't use his skin color to describe him to me, even though he's the only black kid at her school. And there's this notion among white people who think, well, if I teach my kids not to see color, then they won't be racist. And that's not what you should do.
No. Kids are not colorblind. Like, no one's colorblind. No. Kids at age, before age one, no color. And by age two are distinguishing and seeing the differences in how people are treated. So we just totally lie to ourselves when we do that. They see it. And quite frankly, I would like, go ahead, see my color, because that tells you things about me that I don't have to necessarily verbalize. I see things about white people and I go, okay, I know some things about you already, which, yeah, that's part of my bias. That's how I got shaped as well. And part of how everybody gets shaped in how we relate to one another. We've already got that. We should just admit it so that we can move on. Mm-hmm.
They notice it. I mean, when my son was 2.5, I was working in retail, and I live, this particular area of Illinois, Kelly, is predominantly, well, it's predominantly white, and then also Hispanic. Mm-hmm. And so there are very, very, very few black people in this area. But I was working in retail and there was one gentleman at the store who was black. His name was Robert. And my my girlfriend at the time and my son came to pick me up, and I got in the car, and he said, right away, he asked me, he said, who's the brown guy? Mm-hmm. And I didn't really process what he was talking about, because I didn't really think he was paying attention, but Robert had opened the door for me and he saw him. And it occurred to me that in his 2.5 years, I honestly don't know how many black people he'd seen. But that was right. Like the first thing he picked up on was the color difference.
Right.
Feel like to teach kids to not see color is to really just whitewash everything, essentially.
Oh, yeah. Even, so my granddaughter, who I remember when she saw my father for the first time, who's black, there was definitely, I could see the wheels turning in her head. Like, this might be the darkest person that I've seen lately. Like, the first time she met him, you could just see it. They notice it. They even say, they do all this research and they show babies of different races. They show them pictures of the person of their race, so their family and all of the people that they're usually associated with. And they show them a picture of a person of a different color, and babies noticeably shift and wiggle and move around. And they know that their brains are going, this is new. I need to process. Mm-hmm.
Which is why I think it's really important for parents like John and I, whose children are literally confined to spaces where everybody looks exactly the same, to expose them to these conversations and to these issues and to get them involved in order for them to enact policy and enact behaviors as they grow older that are better than what we have, what has come before them.
Yeah. So how do you do that?
How do you do that?
Right. What does that look like?
Exactly. So I guess that transitions into this discussion about the recent Parkland shooting. Well, first of all, I have a 14-year-old who pushes herself so hard during the week that on the weekends she doesn't want to do anything.
Yeah.
Anything at all. Like, she literally stays in her pajamas for 2 straight days. And I was like, we're going to a march on Saturday and you need to put on some clothes and we're going to make some signs and we're going to march for this. This is important. So I took my kids to, I think about 15,000 people turned out in Salt Lake City for the march. Yeah. Both of my kids were, a bit awestruck by the whole scene of it. And that gets in gun violence. I mean, John and I have talked quite a bit about how anti-gun I am. And we won't even get into the whole Dana Loesch situation. If anybody listening doesn't know, Dana Loesch was a mommy blogger. She started out as a mommy blogger. And both Kelly and I know Dana personally.
I was on her show once.
Oh my God. What?
I traveled to St. Louis because it's so close to where I live. And I was, there was a weekend activity thing down there and I was on her show.
Yeah. No way.
Mm-hmm.
What did you talk about?
Before she turned into who she is. I cannot even remember. I mean, it was obviously in the parental vein, mm-hmm. But it is not who she is now. It is, she's a corporate sponsored spokesperson now. And, mm-hmm. But you know what? We live in a corporate sponsored country. So
that's true. Yeah.
Right. Like we don't even know our origins. Like, we have a mythology about this country that, mm-hmm. Is so, so wrong. And we've continued to tell it over and over, and people like her continue to believe it. And, because it's profitable, she'll stay in that lane.
I love that. There is a mythology about the history of this country. Yes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That's the perfect word.
I don't really think we know what it is. This year I've made a concerted effort to diversify my own bookshelves. I spend so much time diversifying everyone else's, like you just mentioned at the beginning, like, thank you for this title. And I look at my own bookshelves and I go, you know what? I have a lot of black women writers that I've identified on my bookshelves. And like, how can I change that up? How can I get out of this binary of thinking about race in the United States as black and white, even though that's the prevalent thought, right? Mm-hmm. And so this year I'm committed to listening to Indigenous voices. And once you start following on Twitter, you know, one person, an Indigenous person, you know how you get recommendations for others.
Yes.
And so one day I went through and I think I have like 100 voices that I'm listening to now. And I'm being very mindful about staying out of those conversations, because I think that there's such a thing as you can have intra relationships with people and then in a community. So I sometimes see it in the black community. We're having a conversation about issues that affect the black community, and there are black people talking about it. And then you have someone come in and, you know, you can see people just go, no, get out. Like, I know this is Twitter, but we were having this conversation amongst us. And I'm watching Indigenous voices and feeling very much like I'm not a part of that community, but I have so much to learn.
Yes.
And listening to those voices has made me sort of come up with that origin mythology about what we know in this country. But I also know, you know, so many of our textbooks, I know this as an educator, continue to talk about Indigenous American Indians in the past tense as if they're no more, mm-hmm. which is so untrue. But it's a challenge to myself, and it's so hard not to get involved with those conversations, but I'm learning a lot about the way they talk about this country is very different from any way that I've ever heard.
Yes. It's interesting that you would say that, because the way the algorithm is working on Facebook and Twitter, most of what I read is from black people. Most of my Twitter feed is black. And
You're in Black Twitter.
I know.
Welcome.
Black Twitter. I was talking about Black Twitter to somebody, and someone was like, "What?" I was like, "Oh, Black. You don't know what Black Twitter is. Sorry." And I've learned so much just by listening and reading and following all of the links and following all of the, you know, the stories that are being written. And I also follow Michael Ian Black.
Yeah.
He was going off about he's like, I want to repeal the Second Amendment. He's like, you know, people of color are disproportionately affected by gun violence. And he's like, and he actually brought up Indigenous people, and someone challenged him and said, how dare you say that? And then he said, let's ask Indigenous people how they have been affected by gun violence. And he gave them this huge platform, and there were like 300 comments from all of these Indigenous people talking about the gun violence in their lives. Mm. And it was so fascinating to read. And I think I'm going to do what you're doing and start following more of those voices. You learn so much by just listening.
Yeah. I do that. I didn't think that that's what I was doing, but I guess I was. I did that with the LGBTQ community.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to learn about transgender. I'm trying to learn about how people use pronouns. And I'm like, I don't know anything. So let me just sit here and listen. Let me just shut up and listen to you talk about your own experiences. So I feel like we can do that in so many communities.
I actually did that with the disabled community. They're yes. one of the reasons that I didn't want to attend the Women's March, because they felt so ostracized. And so I started following all of these disabled twitterers.
it's not entirely inaccurate.
That's true, John.
And you don't, like, this woman was like, I'm tired of going, I can't go see a movie because there are no subtitles. I can't go to a movie theater, you know? And you're like, fuck.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Also, just out of the blue, today is my Twitter birthday.
Is it really?
10 years.
No way.
Yeah. I've been spouting shit for 10 years.
Happy tweeting.
Thank you.
And you become more active on Twitter lately, haven't you?
Yes. I got less active on Facebook. it's interesting because I overshare on Facebook, and I was getting to a part in my life where I didn't feel like sharing everything, and Twitter's so much easier. I'm like, yeah, you can. I mean, you can overshare there. You absolutely can. But it's, as a platform, it made more sense for me to do some advocacy over there. And the more I was sort of staying away from it, the more I would see people tagging me and be like, Kelly, can we ask you a question? I'm like, why am I not using this mm-hmm. in a better way? I think the Educolor community, which is a hashtag that I follow, as well as the hip hop pedagogy by Dr. Christopher Emden are two places where I get the most out of watching and talking and discussing about important things in education and what we should be doing to dismantle racism in education.
Hi, this is Kendra Adachi from the Lazy Genius Podcast, and I am so excited that the new KFC chicken nuggets are here. You have never had nuggets like these before. 100% white meat, hand-breaded in KFC's original recipe, and absolutely delicious. They have become a go-to favorite the kids love to fight over, and I hope they make dinner easier and more fun for you too. Order new Kentucky Fried Chicken Nuggets, now available at participating KFCs near you.
Quick story. Did you text me this? I don't know if you texted me. You were like, "Do you know who this guy named Will Butler is?" Yes. I think he's in a band called Arcade Fire. And I was like, "What? What are you talking about?"
Yeah, you texted me about that too.
Because one of your tweets went viral, and he like followed you because he's really politically active. And I was like, "What? Arcade Fire is following you."
I know. And then I'm like, I should probably listen to their music. I don't even know what they sing. I did, Will Butler. I did. I'm listening now. It's funny because my children are not, like, they're never, I'm sure maybe your kids do the same thing, Heather, but they're never impressed with anything I do online. And so I try. I'm like, look how cool this is. But they were recently most impressed that viral tweet I had about Philando Castile was retweeted by Mark Ruffalo. And they were like, "The Hulk, Mom? The Hulk?"
Oh, was it so, really?
Yeah, I got major points with my sons on that one.
Wow.
And then it fell off. It's over. It's done with. He's also like really politically active. I think what Twitter does, it sort of levels this playing field between you and celebrities or musicians or people that you look up to that are famous, right? And then... Mm-hmm. But it also, the downside is that you can find that someone that you've liked for a really long time has some super shitty opinions.
Oh, yeah.
And then you're like, oh, I can't follow you. I can't even like anything. You're so stupid. I can't. I'm done.
A trans Twitterer went off about J.K. Rowling the other day about the fact that she has promoted anti-trans literature. Oh,
okay, so let's bring that back around to Indigenous voices. They have called out J.K. Rowling for a very long time.
Have they?
And
really?
Yeah, and I didn't know this until I started following their voices, and she has largely ignored them. So yeah, that's a great example of someone who, I mean, she does look good on paper, and most people, and she does talk about a lot of important things, but she also participates in being complicit in continuing to make these voices be marginalized voices.
Yeah.
Like at some point you have to go, what exactly am I using my platform for? So I like what you said about Michael Ian Black, who basically what he did was he passed the microphone. Mm-hmm. Like, just pass your microphone. If you have nothing to say about this because it's not your community, give a microphone to someone who needs it and let them use your platform. That's how you use your privilege.
Yeah. Which bring it back to Parkland. I know you wanted to talk about this. And I've been reading quite a bit of valid criticisms about what's been going on in terms of the support that they have received and the lack of support that people of color have received in terms of gun violence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, a couple things about that. One, I've actually tried to reach out to a couple of the Parkland kids on different occasions and even have asked people, do you know how I can get in touch with them? Because I want to help. I really do want to help. I want to help them avoid some pitfalls that, regardless of how wonderful they have been, they're still falling into. And I think it must be hard to be them right now, because here they have this platform that's in many ways been thrust upon them. I mean, within days they were verified, right?
Yeah.
Days. They were verified. Their followers began to go up. And I just kept thinking, okay, but they're kids still. And I'm totally validating all of the things that are coming out of them, but I also feel like they still need some help in forming things. I don't want to tell you what to do, but we really can't just leave them hanging out there.
Right.
So You know, for instance, they just wrote a manifesto in The Guardian. Did you happen to read this?
I didn't.
And it has a couple of things in there. Apparently it was in their school newspaper, and then The Guardian republished it. And I'm sort of gobsmacked that no one from The Guardian saw some really glaring pieces of this. Much of it was great, but one of the things that they think that should be changed are privacy laws to allow mental health care providers to communicate with law enforcement. And as a Black woman, I'm screaming, no, that is not. I mean, the number of Black people with mental health issues I know who their communities are very clear about, we do not call law enforcement because when we do, they kill us. Mm-hmm. That's a huge glaring piece. And I know that the Parkland students are talking about that their methods are inspired by Black Lives Matter, but you cannot possibly tie police into this. You do not want cops to be therapists. They need more training in their own right. But they are not to be mental health professionals.
No.
And when you consider the history, and this is where I feel like this is just fundamental history that they're missing through no fault of their own. And even perhaps through no fault of their teachers who may or may not have done lessons with the lens of, you know, anti-racism. But we don't need to survey the mentally ill because they're already criminalized and they lack services already. So that was a huge, huge error, I think, that's why I was just like, I would really like to reach out to you and just provide some context for some of the things that you're doing. Now, like, again, on paper, they do look really good, right? They did a fantastic job with the march. They made sure that they had lots of different voices. Mm-hmm. They're constantly talking about intersections, but I still think there's some missing pieces, and we need to help them. We need to help them as they're shaping this.
Right.
But, you know, I guess what it comes down to is that we cannot reduce the gun violence debate at the expense of mental health struggles for people of color.
Right. Well, we actually talked about when the shooting happened, the morning that we recorded. There was a forensic psychologist was on NPR talking about he had studied the guy, the Aurora, Colorado shooter, the theater shooter. Mm-hmm. He had studied him for many, many years. And he said, most people with mental health issues don't commit gun violence. He said, you need to be far more worried about the domestic abuser or the angry coworker or the disgruntled person next door, far, far more than someone who has depression or anxiety.
Right.
And I talked about the fact that I've worked with mental health organizations who, whenever a shooting happens, they're like, here we go again. They're gonna call them mentally ill.
Right.
It's such a stigma. And when you combine that with a person of color in law enforcement.
And right. And ask Indigenous people how that's working out for them right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, ask them about Colton Bushy. Like they have the same exact issues that are going on that don't get highlighted. It's just, we do this thing where we tie mental health to pathological violence when what we're actually talking about is entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
And what I continue to say to people is, I appreciate that we are also focusing on the violence that is happening in communities of color, which happen for a lot of other complicated reasons. You know, white kids are afraid of being shot in school, but Black and brown children are afraid of being shot on their way to school every mm-hmm. single day. And so we have to really look at, like, what's the commonality here? These are mostly white boys in mostly white communities in predominantly white school buildings. Like, we're talking entitlement. We're talking bias. We're talking racism, because there's always they consistently give in to this assumption of good intentions. Like, we didn't know he was going to do this. Last night, I was at dinner with the kids who organized the march here in Springfield, and I found out that one of the girls has a brother. She's from a family who's very conservative, very pro-gun, and her younger brother got an AR-15 for a Christmas present.
Oh, my God.
In like the Midwest, I'm just sitting here thinking, my God, that means I know someone with an AR-15 who's a white boy. Like, that's a really scary thought that I don't think everyone is like giving enough credence to.
Right.
Right. So like when I think about issues of violence as a black girl growing up in a black neighborhood in Chicago, predominantly black neighborhood, those are not the things that scare me. Like the last time somebody called me a bitch, it was a white guy. Last mm-hmm. time, you know, someone in a bar threw a beer bottle at my head, it's a white guy. Like most of the violence I know has come from white men. And we just don't want to talk about that. We're going to choose every other issue to talk about, but that one.
We're talking about you, John.
I'm just listening. I'm not like spacing out here, but I'm giving you the platform.
John readily admits
I'm not going to defend white men. I'm the last person that's going to defend white men.
Yeah.
I mean, you have no ground to stand on when you try to take that stance.
Yeah.
You just don't. And to acknowledge that white men are the problem does not mean that every single white man is a problem. And that's where people get lost. But white men are predominantly the issue.
Right. I was listening to or watching Bree Newsom. You know Bree Newsom, who took down the Confederate flag. And this morning, I knew she would have some things to say about the no charges in the death of Alton Sterling. And she did. And she talked about how our nation has had an uprising in every major American city from 2014 to 2017. Mm-hmm. Starting in 2014, we had Ferguson, we had St. Louis, then we had Baltimore, then we had Charlotte, then we had St. Louis again. St. Louis has some problems. Oh, Lord. St. Louis is it's close enough to me that I've visited enough. My oldest daughter went to college there. The number one question you get asked from anyone in St. Louis is, where did you go to high school? And I feel like that's very telling about how you identify. Because schools are a way for all of us to... schools are a way for us to talk about racism, quite frankly.
Yes.
Right? Like schools are... That's kind of where it's at. And if you're going to talk about racism in schools, you really have to start then... overlaying that with where people live and with housing segregation. And it's almost as if you could take a map anywhere in the United States, and you take a map of that place and you identify like the food deserts, and you identify places where there is no access to healthcare and mental health care. You identify places that have no access to drug treatment, where schools have been closed, where there's no economic opportunity, where there's a lack of access to any quality education. And then you go, you know what those places have in common? Excessive violence. How about we talk about that? One of my favorite lines from this movie called The Interrupters, which is set in Chicago. So John, if you haven't seen this, I think it's on Netflix still. And it's about this group that goes in and really interrupts the gang violence that's happening in different areas. And most of the interrupters are former gang members themselves. And they had this town hall and the mayor came out and they were talking about all the things that we need to be doing in this community because there's all this violence. And this older man stood up and he said, you know, you always come in here and you talk to us about violence and you continue to say this black on black crime, which, by the way, is just, this is my own side note, total bullshit. Because everybody has their own crime. There's white on white crime. It is at the same exact level. It says black on black, Latino on Latino. It's all the same. But you never come in here and talk about jobs. You never come in here and talk about having ripped our communities apart because you put a highway in the middle of it. You never come in here and talk about the infrastructure that you helped to tear down that has created these alternate economics, mm-hmm. right? Like there's an alternate economy in poor black and brown communities, but you only talk about what it is we're doing that's violence, but not that we don't have food or healthcare or a million other things.
It's almost like there's a fundamental, like the chicken comes before the egg, or does the egg come before the chicken? And a lot of white people believe it one way. Like, well, your neighborhoods are violent, and that's why all of this is happening. And it's like, well, no, wait a minute. why would we be so violent? Why would so much violence happen in these places when people right. aren't getting the services that they need, when people are starving?
Right. Or maybe, you know, because you spend all your time going in communities like that and then locking them up. Mm-hmm. Like locking up black and brown men and women. And then what do? Then we turn around and go, well, you know, the problem is you don't have fathers. They're in fucking jail. Like, you can't have it both ways. Like, sorry, that was my, like, I no. had to have one outburst.
No, that's...
I told you that the sky's the limit here.
Well, I just, especially with issues of just putting black people in jail or criminalizing them. That is the other reason why I had to get out and try to do some advocacy work for black children, because of the way I watched them be criminalized. It is the fault of school systems that black and brown children are criminalized. The school to prison pipeline, that's our fault. We did that. We invited school resource officers in, and then we turned over all of our discipline to them. And that it is fucking outrageous the way that continues to happen. And again, let's just bring it back to the Parkland kids, who also see that as, you have to think about this, you know, white people, you assume that the police are there to help you. That is not true for anyone else on the margins.
Right.
The assumption is not that you're here to help us. That's why there's a lack of even, you know, contacting police for different issues. And that's why communities of color will often try to work on those issues themselves and not go outside. So for them to suggest that we need more school resource officers, more police and more cops in buildings, I'm like, no, I want them out. I want psychologists. I want social workers. I want community people who can help make connections for families that need it. I want so much more than cops in a building. That's the wrong way to go.
It's such the wrong. I mean, we're militarizing school systems.
Oh, yeah. I was working with a school in Indianapolis, and they'd said something. Now, I don't, elementary kids were not where I did most of my work. I did middle and high school. But a black teacher came up to me during the break, and she said, so I'm having a problem with something that we've just instituted. We've just put lines down the hallway with tape, and so now the kids have to stay within those lines. And we're asking the elementary students to walk with their hands behind their back and what they call bubbles in your mouth, because elementary kids will sort of blow their cheeks out, but that's just to keep them quiet. And she said, am I on the right track thinking that this feels like a prison? And I said, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You're asking them to be in a even more confined space. Like, you can't, like, if you're in second grade, when I was in second grade, I would have gone to the office and skipped the whole entire way. That's what second graders do. And we're right. asking them to walk in a line with their hands behind their back, almost like they're handcuffed. Mm-hmm. And no talking. Like, the environments that we're creating in school buildings, they may not always look like they may not look like the prison that you have in your mind, but that's a definitely a carceral state that we're creating in a school when we do that. And I really want all of our children to get to behave like children in school.
I think it's so important for especially our listeners to have you come and say this, because of all the experience that you have with this very specific thing. What you have seen, what you have witnessed over and over and over and over again.
I wish I could have worked in places where students of color were just assumed to be brilliant and valuable and have this yearning for knowledge of who they are historically. I wish so much that could have been what it was, but what helped me sort of not feel so alone. And this is where I do most of my work with administrators and teachers of color who ask for my help, is you feel like such an island and like you're the only one who's noticing these things. And you try very hard to say, you guys see this too, right? Like you see this too. And so a lot of what I end up doing is sharing a lot of research and data with them that says, okay, this is exactly what you're seeing. And this is what the research tells us about what you're seeing. We've got research out the wazoo that tells us what we do in that's wrong in schools. What we don't have is anybody implementing programs to like mm-hmm. fix it on a national scale. Like you've got these pockets of people who are doing these fantastic things, in their buildings, but I wish we could make that much more universal. And so one of the things that I share with a lot of people is that a lot of our research talks about when white kids get in trouble in school, it's usually for things that you can see. Having a tantrum or throwing a book across the room or, you know, reaching out and slapping another kid. And students of color often get in trouble and referred to the office for things you can't see, having an attitude or being insubordinate or being disrespectful. And all that is totally subjective, right? That's up to the person writing that referral to say, well, you rolled your eyes at me. That's disrespectful. Or you know. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that we can't correct that behavior, because I know I've had a lot of white teachers say, I cannot believe you let that happen. I'm like, I'm building a relationship with this kid. So if they need to call me a bitch to save face in front of their friends and I need to have a conversation with them about that, that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to write them up for calling me a bitch. That is not the worst thing I've been called in school or life. It's just not. And usually what teachers will tell me is this was an instance where I did in front of a couple of other teachers. I had a student call me a bitch, but here's the deal. I was asking him to go back into the classroom because everyone was out because our bell system was off. So there was this chaos in the hallways and kids were just, we had a lot of substitutes in the building and the kids were totally, they were freshmen. They were taking advantage of all of the subs who were like, oh, I guess that's the bell. And so we're rushing up there to get them in the classroom. And I'm telling kids left and right, you know, get back in class, get back in class. And this one, I said, get back in class, Barry. And he's like, all right. And then he turns around and says, bitch. He tries to say it under his breath, but of course I hear him. And I had three white teachers on me instantly going, oh, you have got to stop that. You have got to call him out in the middle of the hall. You have got to. And I'm like, hey, look at him. He's actually doing what I asked him to do. He went back in the classroom. I'll talk to him later. Like, I'll get to that. But there's this sense of emergency around you have got to stop that behavior. And that's a horrible way that we discipline and give out consequences to Black children. And it actually makes everything worse.
You're coming at it through such an empathic way of treating children. It's like developing the relationship with them, like how desperately they want to trust and want to be able to confide and feel less alone.
Yeah. And giving them some humanity while they do it. Also, like a 15, 14 year old calling me a bitch, totally developmentally appropriate. Like I was 14 once, right? It's like that is actually developmentally appropriate because they don't know how to express themselves. Now, what's wrong with me sitting down with Barry later on and saying, which is exactly what I did. I just saw him in the hallway, called him over. I'm like, hey, Barry, calling me a bitch ain't gonna work for me. Like, that's not what we're going to do. And immediately he went, oh, you know what? I'm sorry. You're right. I was just, you know, standing in my boys and I wanted to be, and I'm like, no, I get it. And what really bothers me is that I could not get the other adults in the room to see that I needed to protect my relationship with Barry.
Right.
And I needed Barry he needed to understand that. He needed to grow and move through that. And, totally worked out because a couple years later, I was actually going to my car and I saw a bunch of kids and they were planning on jumping me. And guess who was in the group? Barry. And Barry, he stopped the whole thing from happening. He's like, y'all ain't messing with her.
Really?
Like, oh, yeah. Yeah. Which I know that doesn't happen all the time. Right. But it to me, it was just like, oh my gosh, had I not built that relationship with that kid, had I not sat and talked to him and allowed him to process what he did and apologize for it, I don't know what would have happened to me.
That's incredible.
People need their humanity.
Where we can find you at beingblackatschool.com.
.org.
And online on Twitter and Facebook, what's the handle?
Mocha Mama. I'm never going to get rid of that. I kind of like it. It fits in so many ways. The coffee, it's the color of my skin. mochamama.com.
We're gonna put a link up to everything on all of our on the webpage and on all of our social stuff. If you could tell the people listening any one thing in particular, I'm gonna put you on the spot like that.
Okay, go ahead, go for it.
What would you want people to know about either the work that you're doing or what needs to change?
I would say that what we probably really need is a deep analysis of what's happening in this intense time of social unrest. And I would just say two words, restorative justice. Like we talk about how people, we want people to get over things is what we want to happen. And we want people of color to forgive all of the things that have happened in this country since its inception. But quite frankly, those things were built. My friend Rebette always says, you know, we have to dismantle racism, but we have to remember that someone mantled it, like it was built. And that there are things that we can do. We have to do them in community with one another. This is not easy work. It's all internal. And we just have to analyze not just how we got here, but how we can restore the justice that so desperately needs to be restored in this country. And we can do that. Like, we're ready for that hard work. So let's get to it.
Yeah. And white people are the ones who need to do the bulk. All of it.
Yeah, because people of color, we're already here. Like, we've already been doing it. So, join us. Your shift is upon you. Clock in.
I like that. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. Really, thank you for giving me this time. I really appreciate it.
No, I think we've been talking about having you on for several months, and especially given the last couple of weeks, I was like, let's get Kelly. So thank you. And I would encourage our readers. I keep saying that.
All of our readers.
Or viewers. Say viewers, too. Viewers. Just get it all wrong.
The viewers, yeah. Everyone listening today, if you would like to weigh in, please do so. Send us your email at stories@manicramblings.com. And you can find us anywhere online at Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Manic Ramblings. And until next time, restorative justice. Many thanks to Tan Lines for the soundtrack, to Lisa Congdon for the cover art, and to Ryan Coomer for his expertise with the editing stuff.
Hey guys, it's Kayla Ewell from Directionally Challenged, a podcast about realigning your internal compass. New KFC chicken nuggets are finally here, and you have never had nuggets like these. All of the delicious KFC flavor you love in one amazing chicken nugget. 100% white meat, hand-breaded in KFC's original recipe. Order new KFC fried chicken nuggets now, available at participating KFC near you. Guys, they're finger-licking good.